This was the week that the tabloids were telling parents to beware of what's lurking in the ears of their children. One mum got an emergency doctor's appointment after she had extracted a worryingly long object from her son's ear using some tweezers. Worried that it was a brain-eating worm, she took it with her to the appointment. It's only when they got home again that her son admitted to stuffing some micropore tape into his ear a week earlier. They never admit to putting anything in their ears when you ask them, do they? And this is Boggle Dogs. Well, I've seen a few sights in other people's ears over the years, but thankfully never a brain-eating worm. Hello and welcome to your happy place. We're your long soak in a relaxing, lavender-infused bubble bath. We're here to keep you going during these difficult times as we take a more human approach to the medical world and learn something along the way. Boggle Docs is the podcast for GPs and other primary care professionals that's accessible to everyone. It takes the pulse of the nation by looking to the medical media and uses that information as a springboard to help you target your CPD. And all of this is aimed at giving us the heads up so that we might have an inkling of what might be on our patient's problem list, so that we know what we need to know. Please subscribe to and rate this podcast because apparently that's really important for all the algorithms in the world of podcasting. And joining me this week, I'm very pleased to welcome back Rex Melville and Rageshri Dehariawan. So welcome both of you back again. How are you both doing?
Good, thank you.
I'm doing fine as well. I'm just getting ready to move to a job up in Coventry, but I'm doing fine, thanks.
You've been sent to Coventry since we last spoke.
Yes, I'm going to be careful not to snap any ladies, nude ladies on white horses in case I get called Peeping Tom.
Yes, that's probably not a good start to a job. But
I'm sorry, that's the obscure reference.
That's all right. Well, I mean, thank you both so much for coming back. We've had such a phenomenal response to the first episode we did all about It's a Sin, and so we couldn't leave it there. We had to come back and talk about the final three episodes. And we've had lots of people sending in voice messages too about what the show's meant to them. So we're going to listen to those a bit later and have a chat about those as well. So we've got lots to cover in today's program. So thank you. As I said, thanks both for coming back in again. But maybe just to, in case people haven't listened to the first episode, please go back and listen to it. But if they haven't, then I just wonder if you could maybe introduce yourself to people that don't know you. So Rageshri, do you want to go first?
Hi, so I'm Rageshri. I'm an HIV consultant at Barts Health in East London.
Excellent. Thank you. And Rex?
Rex Melville. I'm a retired sexual health and HIV physician living in central London.
And which part of you is retired?
Which part of me has retired? That's a question I'll have to tell you off air.
You're going to be trouble, I know that. Excellent. Well, thank you both for coming in. And what we often do with our guests is to ask them if this was a musical of their life that we are watching on stage as we speak, what song would you be singing at the moment? So Rageshri, would you like to go first?
Sure. So I'm not a massive musicals person, but I did watch The Blues Brothers over Christmas. And there's one of the songs from that is Everybody Needs Somebody, which is a song a bit about kind of being in a couple. But actually, I've been on leave this week and kind of reflecting a bit about a year of COVID. And it was my birthday yesterday. So I've kind of just been reflecting about how nice it is to be working as such a part of a community and how everyone in the NHS is really supporting each other at the moment. So, yeah, that's probably where I am at the moment.
Excellent. Thank you. And Rex, what song would you be singing at the moment in your musical?
Well, I've got two and they're both from Sondheim musicals. One's I'm Still Here from Follies. And it's a story of a survivor who's got through this and that and is still punching away at his work and pleasure and social life and still getting through. And the other one is Being Alive from Company, which looks at someone who needs others to stimulate them, needs to be get a kick up the bottom from the world or from his friends to get him on his path and his, well, so his missions can be accomplished. And the last four lines of it are, I'll always be there as frightened as you to help us survive being alive. So it has very much resonances with the HIV/AIDS epidemic.
Absolutely. So thank you. And those musicals are both ones that I would pay money to see. So there we go. Brilliant. So welcome along. And what we're going to do is we're going to be listening to those voice messages, which I talked about. We're also going to be looking at This Week in Daytime TV. We're going to be discussing the final three episodes of It's a Sin. But first of all, I'm going to have a quick chat about the news headlines. And we start with the Mail. Ditch the white bread. Eating more than 7 portions of refined grains a day can increase your risk of death by 27%. It says here that refined carbs, including white bread and pasta, have had fibre parts removed. Scientists looked at the diets of 137,130 people around the world, and those who consumed 7 portions a day were found to be at a 33% higher risk of heart disease and a 47% higher risk for stroke. And this was a study from Simon Fraser University. They looked at the effects following a diet high in refined grains. Next is the Express, how to live longer, modified Mediterranean diet linked to longer lifespan. Okay, so this was published on the Express Online Thursday, February the 25th, 2021. So that was the headline. There is no foolproof guide to achieving longevity, but evidence has landed on some promising strategies, it says. An influential study suggests following a modified Mediterranean diet can increase your chances of survival. So it goes on to talk about all of that. Then it unusually gives us a link to the study. Here we go. So numerous studies have linked a Mediterranean diet to improve survival outcomes. One particular study, Link, published in the BMJ, explored the longevity benefits of eating a modified Mediterranean diet. Doesn't say when it was. Click on the link and it comes to this. Modified Mediterranean diet and survival. EPIC, the elderly perspective cohort study, published in the BMJ, April the 30th, 2005. There we go. The conclusion, though, was that the Mediterranean diet, modified so as to apply across Europe, was associated with increased survival amongst older people. And finally, we had The Sun, and the headline is Home Smear Test. DIY smear tests will be posted to women under plans to boost the uptake of life-saving cancer checks. So this is interesting. It says that tens of thousands of home kits will be sent to patients who are at least 6 months overdue for cervical screening. And what it doesn't say is that it is actually the swab test for the human papillomavirus, so HPV, which obviously is linked to cervical cancer. It's not a smear test. Even though, with the terminology, even the NHS website, and it first starts off, is talking about home smear tests. So that's interesting. So the HPV swab test is going to be sent out to patients at home. Rageshri, is there a story that's caught your eye this week?
Yeah, so I think there's been a headline in iNews. Actually, there were a couple of articles, but one of them, which I want to mention first, is about how It's a Sin has prompted a huge surge in HIV testing. So normally HIV testing week is in November, but this year it was delayed, I think probably due to COVID, and the emphasis has been very much on home testing, and it's just happened to coincide with the screening of It's a Sin. And because of that, there's been record numbers of HIV tests being ordered, which just shows, you know, what a great impact the show has had on HIV awareness. And in the article, it talks about how there's been an increase in terms of gay men wanting to test, but also other groups as well. So some of the groups that weren't shown in It's a Sin, so for example, women, for example, heterosexual people from BME communities. And the issue of HIV in women is really important. So that's talked about in the second article, because obviously women had HIV as well in the 80s and continue to do so. And actually, globally, the majority of people living with HIV are women. So it's really important that kind of the history of women living with HIV and dying from HIV in the 80s and 90s has been recorded so well in this second article, which is also in iNews.
Excellent. Yeah. And I think what's important is, obvious, and for obvious reasons, that It's a Sin didn't cover people such as women who had HIV, because they had to focus the story somewhere. And this article is very fair. It doesn't criticize that, but it's really nice to see that they actually give a different aspect of it too, because there were lots of people who had it that weren't covered in the drama as well. Yeah, have you read those, Rex?
Yes, I read the article, and I realized that much of the work here and the majority of the work in other countries is helping people with HIV who weren't transmitted the infection through male-to-male sex, but in fact who were heterosexual male or female, or even were children who contracted the infection from their mother in the womb. And, of course, intravenous drug users are huge, and the majority of seropositive people in countries like Spain, other Mediterranean countries, and Eastern Europe. So we get many visitors here in our clinics from Russia, Ukraine, other Eastern European countries whose method of transmission was not sexual, but intravenous drug use without clean needles or syringes. And we look after them as well.
The first article, which is, as we said in the iPaper, and it's a sinister spark to surge in HIV testing and a new dawn for awareness. They quote a clinician called Dr. Rageshri Deherawan. That's very interesting. We never had somebody on before that has been quoted in the article. And you make a really interesting point where you say that the inclusion of Roscoe and Ash shows that people from Black and Asian communities were also at risk of HIV as well, which was lovely to see on the TV show. But it's important to talk about that too, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really important because I think kind of visible representation in terms of health promotion, et cetera, is really important to make sure that all communities know that they may be at risk of getting HIV. And in fact, we know from Public Health England data that most people acquire their HIV in the UK. So it's not coming from abroad anymore. It's mainly acquired here. But that happens to be in communities where they perhaps don't have so much health information or access to HIV prevention information or PrEP. So we're still not brilliant at getting awareness and kind of HIV prevention news to these communities. So I think, you know, having those two in It's a Sin made it really clear that, you know, Black communities, as you said, and Asian communities can get HIV too.
Absolutely. So as we've seen, there's been massive press coverage regarding It's a Sin in all media, so TV and also newspapers and everything else. And that's really sparked a massive interest in the public, and also people have had a very emotive reaction to watching it on TV. And we put out a call on social media via Boggle Docs's social media streams on Twitter and on Instagram, asking for people to contact us and leave a voice message and tell us what the show has meant to them. So we've done a montage of people that have contacted us, and it's very powerful in places. And I'd like you both to have a listen to it, please. And we're going to start off with Nurse Jackie, who has spent most of her life at work in primary care, but she started off working with patients who had HIV back in the 80s.
I started my nurse training in January 1981 at Charing Cross Hospital in West London. Lots and lots of vivid memories from that time. But one of the memories that was stirred up again by watching It's a Sin was when I was working on the liver unit. We had lots of men coming in with this mystery illness, AIDS, that no one could tell us anything about. All we knew that was from Haiti, and it affected homosexuals. I can't remember the other H. But I have vivid memories of these poor men being in single rooms, being barrier nursed, and not many people went in to care for them. Everyone was too scared to go into their rooms. And I remember one day thinking, this isn't right. And I just stood outside the door and just thought, sod it, I'm going to go in. Even if I catch something, these men deserve to be looked after and cared for. So I remember going into the room and just seeing loads of urine bottles lined up full of wee. No one had been in to take the bottles away. I remember going into the bathroom and there were lots of plates and used crockery that no one had been and cleared up either. Such a shame. And I remember spending time with the patients, just sitting and chatting. Hopefully it helped some of them.
Jackie, thank you very much for your message and your story. You're obviously a very valuable and caring member of staff. There was much confusion from 1980 to 1986. When we didn't know the exact nature in which HIV was transmitted. In fact, it wasn't even called that until 19, 85. So we had much difficulty with nursing staff, caring staff, and even some doctors who were concerned about their own safety. And we gradually learned that the virus wasn't transmitted through urine, through saliva, and generally through breathing, or contagion through finger touch, skin to skin. But in that time, there was much finger pointing, much stigmatization and isolation of people who had the infection, particularly in hospital, but also outside hospital. And if there was some stigma that they had, which made it perhaps clear, or they were perceived as having HIV, then people would stay clear of them or not want to sit with them in a restaurant or a cafe. So it's a very touching story of yours, and I experienced that myself in Australia at the time.
I think that was a really incredible account to hear from Jackie, and just thinking of her and all the other nurses and doctors and healthcare workers who worked at the time, including you, Rex, just how much respect we have for you guys working during that time when other people were too scared to work with patients with AIDS. And I think she really said, what she said about they deserve to be cared for, these patients, was such a good point. It just made it so, so powerful. So yeah, for me, it's about the huge respect I have for all of you working at that time.
Absolutely. And it feels like that there was this leap of faith where people were actually having to go, what am I going to, we're going to work against what we've been told to do. We're going to have to go into that room against advice, and we're going to help those patients.
Yes, and not only while the patient was alive, but when they unfortunately died, there was often confusion or victimization and difficulties for the family, the removal of the body and cremation or burial, because many funeral directors in most countries declined to take people who were HIV, or if they did act as funeral directors, they would come to the hospital, put the patient in a very thick, opaque bag and tie it up and transfer the patient that way, which is very distressing to everybody and was in a way a giveaway for the family who may have been keeping a secret, or their partners were wanting to keep confidential about the nature of the illness. Similarly, being able to transport someone back to their place of birth by air on planes, it carried on for some time, perhaps 15 years, where the corpse needed to be put in a metal coffin in a plane rather than a wooden one because of fear of infection control problems. And so relatives had to see that spectre of a metal coffin. Very sad.
Very sad. And of course, that also comes up as an issue in It's a Sin. So we'll talk about that a little bit more a bit later on. So we're going to have a listen now to some more voices. So here we go.
Hi, it's Fenella here. Just wanted to say thank you very much for your great podcast and for featuring It's a Sin. What a great programme. I've only seen the first two, and in a way I don't want to see the rest because I know it's going to be really sad and it's also going to end. It's a programme that really resonates with me as a young person in the 80s and 90s, and it makes me think back to my preclinical and clinical years at UCL, because at that time we had two dedicated, quite famous HIV AIDS wards and a firm that people went on to study the disease and look after these patients. But if you weren't doing that firm, you were encouraged not to go on to those wards. And it was quite a scary place, as I can remember. Fast forward 3 years on, when I came back as a pre-registration house officer, those wards were still there, but they were just general medical wards. It was a happy place with no evidence of the trauma and the difficulties that those wards had been for the last 2 or 3 years. And to see that real sort of 360 change in an illness and its perception and its the way people look after these patients in such a short period of time is a real honour to see, because normally great advances take 10, 15, 20 years.
My name's Louise Kerr, and I worked as a staff nurse on an HIV inpatient ward in London from 1990 to 1992. Before I moved to Brighton to go to university, And whilst I was at university, I worked as a bank nurse at the Sussex Beacon, which at that time was essentially an AIDS hospice, including with having its own morgue. After university and children, I returned to HIV inpatient nursing from about the mid-1990s, and from there went into HIV outpatient services, where I stayed until about the early 2000s, before segueing into sexual health and contraception, where I remain today. Watching It's a Sin has been quite emotive, as those experiences of the early UK HIV epidemic did have a profound and lasting effect on me. To see so many young people, mainly young men, inevitably dying in what was really a pretty unpleasant way at the time, and yet the fortitude and courage they showed was nothing if not humbling.
I'm Joanne Welsh, and I'm now the chief exec of a women-specific drug and alcohol service in Brighton. And back in 1992, which was a couple of years after I qualified as a registered nurse, I moved to London and initially worked at King's College Hospital. And I moved to London because I really wanted to work with people with HIV. I'd kind of seen quite a lot about it in nursing press, particularly the way that they were kind of pioneering much more kind of patient-focused care. And I guess watching It's a Sin brought up quite a lot of that for me, made me feel really reflective about the patients who I'd cared for. And I guess most poignantly, really, it made me reflect on, you know, the young people, the fact that so many of the people who I initially cared for in 1992 were really young when they died.
Heather works as a nurse practitioner in A&E.
Last year, when COVID-19 hit us in A&E, I was a nurse practitioner with lots and lots of years of experience. In the 1980s, when HIV hit our shores and was a new pandemic, I remember feeling really frightened, and the COVID experience took me back to the 1980s. We didn't really know what we were dealing with in A&E as a student nurse. I was really frightened. I remember any HIV positive patient, I had to wear gloves. So I was frightened I would contract it in the same way I felt like that with COVID last year.
Here's Louise Kerr again.
Watching It's a Sin reminded me of the fear of contagion that was prevalent in the early epidemic. I particularly remember a very bewildered and terrified looking patient recovering from PCP in a side room on ITU in the late 1980s. And no one was allowed into the room without full PPE. Food was served on disposable plates, and anything that came in the room and out again underwent a full decontamination. The programme also reminded me of the pervasive heteronormativity that existed at this time. And outside of the scene, there was very little public awareness of alternative lifestyles. And this context meant that many LGBTQ plus people were alienated from family at a time when they needed support the most. And I think the intersectionality of the stigma associated with the early HIV epidemic was a huge burden for people to carry. On a more positive note, I think the activism and community response to the epidemic was groundbreaking. The way the community organised itself with things like Switchboard to promote information, advice, support, and to care for one another was inspirational.
Here's Joanne Welsh again.
I guess what was funny watching the programme, and it doesn't feel in some ways like that long ago, but it is kind of 30 years ago, and it just made me think, I think when Colin had his fit, and I kind of thought, oh, I wonder if he's got toxo or PML. And then I kind of thought, gosh, that all is such another world away, really, all those opportunistic illnesses that people used to present with. It did kind of make me think about that, these old kind of manifestations. I remember them kind of saying, oh, you know, we need to go and ask such and such a consultant who used to care for people. For example, with TB, patients taught us so much about how to live really. And, you know, also something about how courageous people can be and the extent of what people can live with and tolerate and still find some real quality of life. And I guess that's something about how young people were, but they were still kind of trying to squeeze out every bit of life that they could from what they'd got, despite on occasions having really awful symptoms and problems. So that's what I kind of remember, really.
So there you go. Rageshri, what was that like to listen to?
Incredibly powerful, isn't it, to hear real stories of what actually happened. And I didn't know until Louise said that the Sussex Beacon actually had its own morgue, which is kind of wow, that was needed. I think some of the themes which really struck out were just how young the patients were, but how much courage they had and how they knew how to live. And also the bits about the community activism and how actually patient care was really pioneering at the time because it was so patient focused. That really stuck out for me.
Yeah, and I think interesting what you're saying about the Sussex Beacon as well, and it kind of goes on from what Rex was talking about earlier as well, in that they needed it, because I actually got a friend that worked there, and I spoke to her about this last night, actually, and she was saying to me that that was at a time when undertakers wouldn't come and pick up patients who died. But what's so lovely is how things come full circle. And what she told me, which is makes you sort of well up a little bit, and is that now the morgue isn't the morgue anymore. It's now the creche. And it just shows, you know, people with HIV can have babies, and, you know, it's not passed on. And it just shows how far we've come. And that to me was such a powerful kind of representation of how things have changed. So that's a really nice thing. Any of those particular messages that you were thinking about, Rex?
Yes, it brought back to me many of my experiences in the wards and in outpatients in the 80s and 90s, particularly before 1996 and 7, when we had the revolution of more potent drugs and a sudden diminution in the death rate and illness and symptoms in patients. And people were distressed. We had lack of information about how transmissible someone's condition was. And I thought that our speakers were very eloquent and touching and had great memories about what they had gone through. And they sounded like very valuable members of the healthcare team. One of the things that probably Louise touched on was the fact that patients started to own their own illness. By that I mean they learned about it far more than many other patients do with a chronic or acute condition. And they said, well, look, these doctors don't seem to know what they're talking about. And they may have been talking about their GPs or different consultants, not necessarily those on the wards who were pretty well up to date. And they said, I'm going to learn about this. So they would go, they couldn't go on the internet, but they could look up whatever they could about their condition and their virus and their complications and their and they started to tell us a thing or two. And we thought, oh, okay, we've got to be on our mettle here. And patients started to become the experts rather than the doctors, which was surprising, often a bit upsetting to the healthcare team. And they were quite bolshy about it. It did lead to activist groups who made things very uncomfortable for us and at international conferences. But we learned from them. Ultimately, they took things in their own hands. As Louise said, they would start switchboards when they were caring for and answering problems with their friends online. People would ring up desperate. And so gay people or their people who were supporting, it's usually MSM, particularly in West London, they, like Jill in It's a Sin, decided to lend a helping hand, and new networks and friendships were formed, and patients started to learn how to be experts and led the way. They were the first group with a chronic illness to be able to do that and have informed all the other specialties since that time. And so in a way, they were revolutionary.
And so our expert patients were born, and this is where they came from, isn't it? And, you know, we we rely on them in so many fields now, in cancer care, as you were saying, in diabetes, all sorts of chronic conditions now have benefited from that legacy. So we're going to come back and talk about the rest of Itacin in a moment. But first, let's have a quick look at the week in daytime TV. And on Monday on BBC Morning Live, Dr. Zan van Tulleken was on, and he was introducing us to the new BBC initiative called Headroom, and that's there to help us all with our mental health. And it's a new mental health toolkit, and I'll post a link to that in the show notes. And they were talking about it the other week on BBC Breakfast. And basically, it's this new toolkit, as we talked about, which is aimed at all age groups. So there's something on there for all age groups to help them with their mental health. On the same day, on Monday, on Steph's Packed Lunch, they had life coach Michelle Elman, and she was talking about the importance of setting boundaries in your life and being able to say no. And indeed, she was talking about the joy in saying no, and there's a very good interview there, and I'll post that in the show notes as well. On Tuesday, Dr. Philippa Kay was talking to Eamon and Ruth about bowel cancer screening, the importance of posting your test back when you've been sent the kit. And also her own battle with bowel cancer. And she's written a book, which is out now, entitled Doctors Get Cancer Too, A Doctor's Diary of Life and Recovery from Cancer. And I'll post the video of that interview in the show notes. Also on this morning, on Wednesday, Dr. Sarah Kayat was on, and she was talking about all things hay fever, with sufferers set for an early start this year because unseasonably warm temperatures can cause a mini pollen bomb as a result of trees spewing clouds of allergens into the air. And so she was talking all about the different remedies and bits and pieces. I'll put the link to that in the show notes as well. And finally, on Thursday, Ranveer Singh was sitting in for Lorraine, and she was talking to Nicky Campbell, and he was very emotionally talking about how he's dealt with and been dealing with his diagnosis of bipolar, and how his dog Maxwell helped him through all of this. And he's written a book, and I'll put a link to that interview in the show notes as well. Okay, so now it's time to talk about Itacin, which we talked about the first two episodes in our first podcast episode on this. And so now we're going to talk about the final three episodes. So episode three was set in March 1986, and it centered around the story of Colin. So Rageshri, what did you think when you saw this?
I was really devastated by this. I think I'd slightly fallen in love with Colin, and then in this episode, his mum as well. Who was just so lovely. I think the storytelling was particularly good here because obviously we didn't know what was going to happen, but because we didn't know that Colin had had sex, it was unexpected for him to be the first person to present with symptoms of HIV and AIDS. So I think that was very cleverly done.
Exactly. And I have to say, I fell for it hook, line and sinker. He was the strong, silent type, wasn't he? And bless him. He was so such a lovely, lovely chap, and the kind of guy that you just want as your mate, wasn't he? And it was so devastating to watch. The Terence Higgins Trust, who've had phenomenal social media feeds over this, and they posted a feed about it, or posted a message about it on Twitter, saying that Colin's storyline in Itacin, it led to a 4,300% increase in searches for "Does AIDS cause fits?" I mean, that kind of thing clearly happened then. And I think I can remember an example of a patient when I was a newly qualified house officer who was fitting and the underlying diagnosis was HIV. I'm guessing that it doesn't happen so often now, but it's not impossible for it to keep happening because we've talked about late presentations, haven't we?
Yeah, absolutely. So we still see PML far too frequently. Fits can be a presentation of toxoplasmosis, of other types of viral infections, for example. So I think if anyone has a fit for the first time, an HIV test should definitely be done. And on a similar vein, also dementia, so symptoms of dementia. We often think dementia is irreversible, but actually in HIV, it's something that can be reversed. So again, doing an HIV test, especially in someone who perhaps on the younger side with dementia, is an important test to do.
So Rex, what did you think about the Colin storyline?
In a way, I was rooting for him because he seemed to be a sensible presence amongst all the hedonism going on and the silliness. And when he fitted, it does fit in with the HIV, and it is one of the risk symptoms. And I guess it would say to the clinician that there is a lesion in the brain. The four lesions I could think of which can cause fitting would be toxoplasmosis, which is a usually takes the form of an abscess, the central nervous system lymphoma, tuberculosis in the brain. And as Rageshri said, PML, the progressive multifocal leukoencephalopathy, which is a more dramatic and rapidly evolving form of dementia and neurological disease in HIV. And typically the CD4 count is very low, as you'll know. It's usually, but not always, 50 or 100 or less. So that was consistent with him having a lesion inside his brain. And PML does actually cause this, whereas HIV encephalopathy, which is called different things in different countries, and it's not so much an encephalitis, but a defunctioning of subtle parts of the brain gradually, we don't usually get fitting in that typical HIV dementia. It's more a personality change, and we don't get sudden neurological events.
With Colin, the bit that broke my heart was when he'd been diagnosed and he knew it sunk in that he had the diagnosis. And this is where the drama was so powerful, and it comes back time and time again to the stigma regarding AIDS and HIV. And he turned to his mum with tears in his eyes and he just said to her, "I'm not dirty." And then he said, "Does everybody die from AIDS?" And that was so beautifully done. But wow, what a kick in the stomach that was.
There's one bit where the doctors are talking to his mum first and telling her his diagnosis, and they said it's incurable. And she just says, "What does incurable mean?" And I just thought, my God, that's such a powerful, you know, way of showing that how sometimes our language doesn't always, it's not always understood by everyone, and how the care we need to take, especially when talking about something as serious as that. Yeah, incredibly powerful.
Exactly. And I think coming back to what you were saying again earlier, Rex, in the whole issue regarding undertakers not taking away sort of people that had died from HIV. And there's a scene whereby Colin's mum is talking to his friends about the funeral process and about how she's having a problem getting anybody to even plan a funeral with her. And that was really heartbreaking to see as well. So let's move on to episode 4, which was set in March 1988. And it started with the tombstones, the advert, the AIDS Don't Die of Ignorance advert, which they were all watching. And that was powerful to see. And it started off with the friends going to lots of different friends' funerals, which was clearly what happened a lot at the time. So, Rex, is that something that you saw a lot of back in the day?
I saw it for the perception of a physician and a GP earlier, who had to decide whether to visit patients' funerals and not only friends' funerals. I didn't have a flood of friends' funerals. I was very lucky, whereas many people of my age and who were MSM had many patients who died, and they just had burnout from funerals, and they eventually stopped going to them for some time because they were too distressing, even if they knew the person and loved them. But I'd be interested to ask Rageshri too about how she feels about doctors attending patients' funerals. It's much easier when it's an open secret, the diagnosis, because the HIV doctor attending the funeral confirms the situation of the patient's diagnosis and is not incongruous. But when you have a heterosexual or a someone from the African diaspora, or in a community where HIV is even more anathema or stigmatized than in the gay community, the MSM, then I was not welcome at patients' funerals because I was a giveaway. And if the HIV specialist was there, perhaps I could disguise that as being an infectious disease consultant, then their family would be started to be asked questions by the relatives. What's that doctor doing at the funeral? So it's a complex social situation arose and still does now. It's that that situation hasn't gone away because of the secrecy around HIV?
I have to say, I've never been to a funeral of a patient before. I haven't been asked. I think part of it is we just have far fewer funerals now than we had then, so our patients die less often. But we do get similar issues, I think, sometimes when we're looking after patients on the wards who haven't told their relatives about their HIV. So when we're trying to communicate with them, talking about just being, you know, their ward doctor or an infectious diseases doctor is a way of getting around it, but it can be very difficult. And, you know, part of the counselling that's offered is around sharing status with families, but it's not always possible. There can be many reasons why patients don't. So I think it can be a really awkward scenario, which we do still see sometimes. But I think thankfully we don't have so many funerals anymore.
One of the things that happened in the narrative was that Richie had an HIV test and he had it under his own name. And then he didn't go back for the result. And I guess that happened quite a lot back in the day. But my thoughts on that now would be, because eventually he went back under a different name and he got the result and he knew his status. But if somebody came now to a sexual health clinic and they had an HIV test that was positive, would that happen, that there would just be a positive test that would be sat there? Or how would you make sure that that patient gets the help that they need?
So we've got various protocols for doing that. So sometimes a patient comes in and they have a rapid test, so they're there and then, and we're giving them the result then. Sometimes it is a blood test and we, you know, try and make sure that we've got the right phone details. But occasionally we do lose people. So especially, for example, in opt-out testing, we've had an opt-out testing scheme in A&E in the last year at the Royal London. And those are people who have just said yes to having an HIV test as part of workup for other things routinely. So trying to chase up some of those patients has been a challenge. So we have, you know, protocols where we'll contact them by various means, by phone, by text, by letter if we have to. And then if we can't get hold of them because it's in their best interest for them to know, we'll then contact their GP and try and contact them that way. We're very aware, obviously, in terms of patient confidentiality, that contacting the patient first is always our preferred option. But if we really can't get hold of people, it doesn't happen very often at all. But when it does, we will try other means, which can be via their GP. And we've always had a lot of great help from GPs with that in the past.
So episode 4 finished in a devastating way. And that was when Richie realised what his diagnosis was. And he went back to the Isle of Wight and he caught up with a friend of his. And made a pass at him. Didn't go well. but they had a heart to heart afterwards. And he said, I could have done anything, but I never will now. And it was kind of his realization that he felt that his potential and his life had been cut short. And so the beginning of episode 5, which is the final episode, which is all about Richie's story. And it starts off in November 1988, when Richie's in a successful play and his family come to watch him and he gets a standing ovation. And it's lovely to see. And then literally and very brutally, it cuts to November 1991, 3 years later, and Richie's in bed and he looks really, really ill. And it transpires that he's not told his parents yet. And there's this collusion whereby Jill and his friends are all working together to try and protect him from having to do that. And then he becomes much more unwell. And he ends up in hospital and his parents come. And there's a very, very sad scene where Richie has to come out to his parents as gay and also tell them that he's got HIV and AIDS as well. And I guess that happened quite a lot back in the day. Rageshri, do you think that happens so much now? Hopefully not.
Hopefully not quite as often, and less people get AIDS these days. They often diagnose much, much earlier. I'm not sure I can really comment about in terms of people coming out to their parents. Perhaps Rets could talk a bit more about that, but I'm sure, you know, there still is a lot of homophobia in society. So, you know, I'm sure that probably does happen a lot still.
Yeah, I mean, Rex, it just struck me that it was a double whammy to have to deal with. I think it was dealt with very well in the drama. Was that something that happened a lot back then? I guess it must have done.
Yes, counsellors talk about coming out twice, coming out as a gay person, an MSM, and coming out as having HIV. Perhaps as the third one is coming out as being ill and not having long to live. So, in fact, the coming out process is complicated, and occasionally people are outed unnecessarily by others, either accidentally or maliciously.
And so, I think the rest of the show is dealing with Richie's illness and the shame and the stigma surrounding it. And there's lots of very powerful conversations. There's one where Richie's talking to his mum, and he says, what do people know? What do the neighbours know? What does Auntie Kath know? I don't want it to be a secret. And then he turns to his mum and says that he had so much fun. And he basically talks about the fact that he didn't regret any of it. And he goes through some quite graphic stuff, which his mum is obviously finding very difficult to acknowledge and to talk to him about. And he says to her, do you understand? And she looks at him and just says, no. And that's when he says to her, that's why I need Jill. And then if you've seen the show, you know what happens. We're not going to ruin it for you, but it's really important. But what transpires at the end of the show is this hugely powerful speech between Jill and Richie's mum. And it's all about the stigma. And Jill says to his mum that he was ashamed, and he kept on being ashamed. He kept the shame going, and he did this by having sex with men and infecting them and running away. And that, to me, answered a question, because earlier on in the piece, Richie had told his mum and his friends that he knew he had HIV, and yet he was sleeping with men and passing it on. And when I first watched that, I was quite troubled by that, because I thought, why have they made us think badly of Richie? You know, he was the main character in this. Why, apart from making him human, why have they done that? But it's all explained in that conversation between Jill and his mum. And it's all about this ongoing shame, because they say that he thought he brought it on himself and he deserved that. This stigma is still going now, isn't it, Rageshri?
It really, really is. And, you know, sex should not be associated with shame. It shouldn't be associated with death. It should be fun. It should be consensual and without shame. And, you know, it really still is the case. And, you know, there are still quite a few countries, including the UK, where you can be criminalised for passing on HIV. So in the UK, there is still, you can be charged with reckless transmission of HIV. And, you know, that in itself can contribute to the stigma and the shame, and those laws should still not be around, because it's assuming that passing on HIV means that you're going to cause someone else to die, which isn't the case anymore. We also know that most HIV is passed on by people who don't know they have HIV, because everyone else is on medications and know they won't pass it on. So yeah, it still is around, and people still think that they brought it on themselves. And it's just really incredibly sad that that still is the case. And that's such an important part of kind of counselling and psychology when people are diagnosed, to try and get them past that. It's tough.
And I think it's when any illness is stigmatised, that's when you end up with problems and you end up with behaviour like that. And we should remember that with anything going forward, because, you know, in our lifetimes, there may be another illness that comes through that follows a similar pattern. And we need to be very aware of that stigma. And I think when Jill said, the wards are full of men who think they deserve it. They're dying, and a little bit of them thinks, yes, this is right. I brought this on myself. It's my fault, because the sex that I love is killing me. And that was very powerful. Rex?
Yes, I, in some ways, not to lighten it, but I would feel it ridiculous to shame someone for having a sexually transmitted condition. And to expect that they didn't enjoy getting it. Because what about the millions, the hundreds of millions of people who acquired it heterosexually and still have it? They think of someone in a so-called normal relationship in Africa. The wife is monogamous. She has she's having sex, pleasurably or not, with her husband, and she's transmitted the infection to her. Why should she be disgraced or stigmatized by having a normal, enjoyable sexual life? That's all she has done. She has not gone out and had any what would be called promiscuous behavior. So, in fact, her penalty for being a dutiful and loving, caring citizen is to have HIV. So how dare we call HIV a penalty or a stigmatizing bad infection for someone to have? It's just a matter of, unfortunately, it's a fact of life, and people should be cared for, you know, without discrimination.
And I think to wrap things up and to try and think about the learning points for us generally and in primary care. So stigma is something we need to tackle whenever we see it, and not just with HIV, with any illness. And I think, as we're saying, for the future, if we think things are getting stigmatized, we need to act to stop that from happening, no matter what the illness is. And also, so testing as well. We need to make sure that we have a look at those new guidelines to think about what the index cases are that we think we should be testing for, and promoting the free testing kits as well, which were promoted in HIV Testing Week. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. So, I mean, is there something that, Rageshri, with your work where you are at the moment, is there anything else that we need to be tackling?
That's a good question. I think it's also about supporting people to stay in care and on treatment. So taking medication every day for the rest of your life is a really hard thing to do. And, you know, people struggle with that with all sorts of chronic conditions. And often for people living with HIV, taking their tablet is a reminder of having HIV. So it'd be really great if GPs, when they're seeing their patients about something else, could also say, how are you getting on with your HIV medications? Are you having any issues? They, you know, is there anything you want to talk to me about? So just kind of supporting patients with adherence and engagement in care would be massively helpful, because then it's not just coming from us, it's coming from multiple healthcare professionals.
Excellent. So thank you both for joining me today and talking about all of this. And I think that sometimes trying to tie it all together, you can think about how maybe if you could have sent yourself a message back through time at the beginning of a difficult part of your medical career, what you would say in that message. And I know that we had a little chat before, Rex, about what you would have done if you'd written a letter to yourself back in the 80s from now. And I believe you have something to share with us.
Yes, I do. I've written a letter to my younger self. I'm going to read it because it's much safer for me to do that, because as you imagine, if you wanted to talk to your younger self who'd been through some difficult times, I don't think you could keep a dry eye. So I'm going to read this fairly dispassionately. You might even hear a little bit of rattle of paper. And I'm going to delve into my past and talk to my younger self. May I start? Thank you so much.
Please do.
Hello, younger Rex, wherever you are. Are you still living in Melbourne? Then you are going to spread your wings. If you can hear this from the year 2021, you can guess that you've survived this far. Does that surprise you? You will muddle through life by using great intuition and sense of what's useful and safe, but you're also drawn to exciting and stimulating experiences and career paths. You may be aware that you had already gathered lots of social outsiders to your general practice in Carlton in Melbourne. So you had to learn the basics of gonorrhea and all those STDs in the early 1980s, and about a new condition killing off gay men in the US. So this all makes for a rich medical soup for you when you add in the working class families from the tower blocks across the road. You will always be drawn to outsiders, so you'll never get bored. And you will keep walking a tightrope between becoming part of your patients' lives and turning off at 6 o'clock after clinic. And keep up those voice lessons and taking roles in Cole Porter musicals after hours. It all comes in handy even 40 years later. And yes, you catch the musical's bug when you come out as gay, but very late. Have you yet gone through your period of burnout in Sydney when you couldn't work for 6 weeks? Too much paperwork, and your HIV patients transferred to St. Vincent's Hospital, where you could only watch them waste away because you had no treatment rights there back then. So a smile was all you could give them and hold their hand. Don't worry, Rex, you bounce back and travel to London and earn those treatment rights in inpatient care there. for years and years and years. Are you perhaps a do-gooder, though? Your missionary streak will take you to tiny Burundi in the heart of Africa, and you'll manage to teach doctors and nurses in French while you get a taste of Tutsi and Hutu culture and their desolation and poverty after a murderous civil war. You'll even get to like their rubber chicken and that tasteless cassava, and to take them to meet a group of pygmies, themselves outsiders, who sing for you outdoors in the heat and dust. You will initiate at least 3 medical firsts, but your lack of interest in promoting yourself has kept these buried. So get help in publishing in journals, please. And I'll ask you to kindly record your experiences from day to day in detail, even if you keep a diary a secret. It's been damned hard for me trying to piece your life together, especially what was inside your head, Rex. And by the way, I'm surviving a new pandemic while writing this in London. So hold on to your hat. Life can be wonderful. But you know that.
Oh, thank you, Rex. That's lovely. Really, really lovely. Well, thank you to Rex and Rageshri for coming on today and sharing your thoughts on Issasin. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you both back.
Thanks so much for the invite.
Brilliant. Well, thank you both. Take care of yourselves and hopefully chat to you again in the future. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
And that's just about it from us for this week. Thanks to all of our contributors who called in, to Jackie and Fenella and Louise, Heather and Joanne. Thanks for all that you did back in those very difficult days in the 80s and 90s and for sharing that with us, to give us a very valuable perspective on what it was like to care for patients with HIV and AIDS. And thanks again to Rex and Rageshri too. Don't forget that this is the last week for the free code for gpcpd.com, where you can get 1 month of free access to GP Update and the Mental Health Update online handbooks. All you need is your code, which is New Year Gift. And if you go over to gpcpd.com and you go to the login or register page, and at that point you add in the code. If you don't have an account already, then you can go to my account and register an account, and then you can put the code in there. And the New Year gift code can be redeemed once only per account, and it must be redeemed before the 28th of February 2021. So there's still time to get that in there. Fans of Red Whale's Dr. Fraser might have spotted the actor who plays the registrar, Dr. Kumar Clark. That's Chris Machari. And he is in an episode of It's a Sin. And if you watch episode 3 very closely, then he's the doctor who tells Ash that he doesn't have HIV. Now, if you head over to the Buzzsprout site, then you can click on all the links in the show notes. And the easiest way to do that is to Google Buzzsprout Boggle Docs or go over to our social media pages and click on the link in the bio. We are at Boggle Docs on Instagram and Twitter. And the other thing to do is if you click on the link in the bio, then you can leave us a voice message telling us about anything that you've heard or seen or think that we should be covering, or even leave us a message about something that you've heard on Boggle Docs too. So will our patients want to talk to us about reducing their refined carbs? Maybe. Could they have seen the piece on This Morning about bowel cancer and be worried about that? Quite possibly. Or will they have been affected by It's a Sin? And thinking about that, what can we all do to change the ongoing stigma of HIV? I've put a link in the show notes to some resources all about that. I'm Nick Kendrew, and you can find me on Twitter at Nick Kendrew. That's N-I-K-K-E-N-D-R-E-W. Until next time, take care and look after yourselves. Goodbye.